Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Alexander Pushkin, who lived from 1799 to 1837, is Russia's most beloved poet, and Eugene Onegin, his novel in verse, is considered the most influential work in Russian literature. On today's This Week in America, we welcome back acclaimed poet, translator, scholar, and celebrated author Martin Bidney, who has created something utterly unprecedented, a verse interview book. With his internationally acclaimed Alexander Pushkin's verse novel, Eugene Onegin, a form-true dialogic verse translation with lyrical replies and supplements. For every 14-line stanza Pushkin wrote, Bidney responds with a Pushkin-style reply poem, turning the translation into a living dialogue. Two verse novels in conversation across centuries. The result is not just a translation, but a collaboration with genius. Bidney, Professor Emeritus of English and Comparative Literature at Binghamton University, has spent decades crafting poetic dialogues with literary giants. His work is praised by leading scholars as a groundbreaking application of dialogic approach to literature. His wide-ranging fascination with revelatory writing stems from Patterns of Epiphany, where Martin pioneered a method of analysis he has applied to over 20 authors. In his first 23 years of his rewirement, he has published 61 books of original and translated poetry, often including both in what he calls verse translation interviews, with poets he has read in Polish, Russian, German, and French. Join us for a deep and delightful conversation about poetry, translation, literary history, and what happens when a translator becomes a collaborator. We welcome back to This Week in America, Martin Bidney. Martin, welcome back to the program. It is a pleasure to have you back with us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I've been waiting for this since the last interview that we did. And by the way, if you go to our YouTube channel, you'll be able to see that, or go to thisweekinamerica.us and be able to listen to that interview. This is really a fascinating topic that you have, a project that you are involved in and receiving international raves. What stimulated you to write a book dialoguing with Pushkin's Onegin?
Well, actually, it ties in with the last interview that we did about Shakespeare. I wanted to do some more like that. And when I encountered Pushkin, I discovered that he had set me an example, because in his Eugene Onegin, which is a novel in poems, he introduces himself all the time as a character, not just a storyteller. He's Onegin's, this is a fictional, and Onegin didn't exist, but the author barges in and says, you know, I was Onegin's best friend for a while, and we used to talk about this and that, and that's the way the whole book goes. You wind up learning a whole lot more about the author, or at least as much as you do about Onegin, and the lady who's in love with him, Tatiana, who's one of the great female heroes of Russian literature, and personally reminds me very much of another wonderful hero friend of mine. That is Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. So
we have all that to talk about. Boy, there's a lot that we're going to discuss during our program today with Martin Bidney, by the way. All the information on Martin and all the books, and you can order those there as well, at his website, martinbidney.org. And we've got that on our website. You can link on and go directly to his website. Martin, how does Pushkin set an example for your conversational art? How did that work?
Well, I'll show you, okay? Let's read page one, chapter one. On the very first stanza that Pushkin wrote, he writes, by the way, sonnets in a form he invented. First of all, he speeds up the tempo by 20% by writing in 4-beat lines instead of 5. You know, Shakespeare wrote, "Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate." He's writing there to one of his love poems to his boyfriend, and it's in 5s, and 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and 5. But Pushkin writes, "Мой дядя самых честных правил, когда не в шутку за не мог, он уважать себя заставил и лучше выдумать не мог." Like that, you can see it really moves along.
Yes.
These are page page-turner sonnets, I call them. So here we go. My uncle, man of meet demeanor, that is very proper behavior, when he at last indeed grew ill, required attendance. Nothing keener was felt by that relentless will. His life a moral may afford, but how to keep from being bored all night, all day with bedside chat, and never take a break from that? What creeping, cheating, and deceit to keep the dying entertained, puff up the pillows, then look pained to bear a medicine not sweet, and think the deadline's overdue. When will the devil come for you? This is really plunging you into the action. He's there at the deathbed. This man actually, for some time, we don't really get to know terribly well. He thinks of himself as somehow apart from people, destined for a special fate. He has basically a Napoleon complex, I would call it. He makes himself, Onegin does, the comparison quite clear. And let's see. What is he doing here? He's at the deathbed of a rich relative, and he's trying to be as nice as he can. He wants to be left as much of a bequest as possible. You see, he really thinks he's doing a rotten thing. He does have a kind of, I guess, half-baked morality, because it doesn't stop him from sitting there and watching the man die and thinking, how long is it going to be until I inherit what's due me? It's not an edifying scene. Anyway, I decided I would dialogue about this, and here's my reply. Friend Zoya, learning I had made a promise when at last retired, I'd write a sonnet daily, weighed the thought. If sonnets be desired, Onegin why not render? You may entertainment find, and too, will have some practice at your craft. At first I, quite unwisely, laughed. Onegin Englishers are not, and never were, in short supply. I read one scholar writing a decade ago who said that there are 20, at least, I don't know if she had done an exhaustive search, translations of Onegin already available in English. Onegin Englishers are not, and never were, in short supply. Another needed? Really, why? I too quick thinkingly forgot. My heart could write replies and be a partner in a colloquy. That's always my ambition these days, you know, in my verse translation interviews. I translate a poet. Every poem, every sonnet that he wrote, and there are hundreds of them in his book, I translate and reply to. So it's quite an adventure. After all, this is Russia's greatest poet. Everybody agrees on that. Nobody fights about it. So let's continue with this story. So mused our junior rogue, who flying on post horse left a dusty trail. The most high will of Zeus undying would him as heir of many hail. Friends of Lyudmila and Ruslan, a hero and his beloved in an earlier story poem by Pushkin, I'd like, before he's farther gone, to introduce you, if I may, to this my hero. Let me say, Onegin, friendly reader, on the shores of the Neva was born. That's river that flows through St. Petersburg. St. Petersburg being a city on the banks of the Baltic, which is, I went there, as you'll see in my reply. The shores of the Neva, where maybe you as well the morn of life enjoyed and later shone. At times I've strolled there happily, but northern air's bad for me. We're only in the second stanza of the poem, but he's managed to talk a good bit about himself, hasn't he?
He certainly has.
And so now I'll reply to that. See how he sets me an example to just barge in? I'm going to do that right now. I feel again the fall-like dawn of August that our poet's known, where autumn life already shone. The rhyme's not right with Venus' zone, but Grecian gods will play a part. We've seen it at the very start. In Petersburg, I, strolling through the cold that chilled the wintry dew, felt glad. Petersburg is so far north that there are, every year, a whole series of days on which the sun does not shine and never rises. In Petersburg, I, strolling through the cold that chilled the wintry dew, felt glad. Two friends along, pray note, had come, each asked with lovely face if she a gloveless hand might place within a pocket of my coat for added warmth. I, blessed, agreed. It seemed a fair request, indeed.
So well done. I enjoy that so much. And we have much more coming during the course of the conversation.
Thank you. I get to converse with the narrator is really a much more interesting guy most of the time than Onegin. But luckily, he barges in often enough where I can carry on little conversations. Okay, now we're going to talk about Eugene getting educated. We all have learned to master this and that in amply varied ways. Well-bred, we fit right in. We won't miss the prompt reward of social praise. Onegin could his speech endear to stringent critics and austere. Well-read, if a pedantic lad, he happily the talent had in conversation unconstrained to touch but glancingly on themes with look that filled with learning seems, in grave debate be self-contained, and then, surprise, make ladies smile whom flashing epigrams beguile. Here's my reply. This is, Onegin is not a trend setter. He's a trend follower, but a very, very good one. With skill which had the fair maiden, beguiled, our wise Onegin prophesies the time when sprightly Oscar Wilde with lightning wit might quips devise. How fallen, how changed our life today. I lately heard a student say, it's kind of like, I'm going, whoa. And she's like, wait. And it's sort of like, she's going to go. And how uncool is that? And, oh my God. It's like the scene where if the guy just got to stay, the chick will go, I mean, no way. I got a bit carried away there. But I actually heard something very like that on a bench when I sat down on campus lately at Binghamton University, where I taught for 35 years. And I heard a conversation that involved a talk in that kind of language. So I just basically got tuned in on how certain people speak and think. Now we continue with the education. The day of Latin long is gone, and so the simple truth to tell, of Latin he enough might con an epigraph to guess at well. Of Juvenal to chat a bit, satirist, say vada for so long, that's it. Two lines from Virgil might he claim. He'd no desire to rummage through the piled-up chronologic dust of history's traditions trust, but anecdotes, and not a few, from Romulus until today, he gladly gathered on his way. Well, I took a couple of years of Latin, so let me barge in the Pushkin tradition and do that. Upon the Latin classroom walls, my teacher sayings gravely place. Per aspera ad astra, tall's the tree that heaven bravely faced. And then, O quam ridiculi mortalium sunt termini, how risible the endings are of dizzied men in war who spar. O tempora, O mores, times and habits bad. The age of gold thus anciently was bought and sold. In Latin and in Anglo rhymes, we sad acknowledge to our costs. We diced for paradise and lost. Well, that's perhaps enough on the background of Onegin. Shall we turn now to Tatiana? First, we're going to introduce her younger sister. We've got two sisters here, Olga and Tatiana. And interestingly, Pushkin introduces Olga first. There'll be a little more suspense. There's always going to be a certain amount of mystery about Tatiana. She's like Jane Eyre. She's a solitary. She's contemplative. really a whole lot more of a poet than Olga could ever be, beautiful as that lady might also appear. So here we are in chapter 2 and canto, or rather stanza 23. Shy, modest, and obedient, forever happy as the morn, poetic, lived, and guileless, lent a kiss that spoke of love newborn, with sky-blue eyes that light beguile, from with flaxen tress and ready smile, her movements, tone, slim figure, all in Olga. Reader, please recall some novel, any. You will find her portrait, lovely, sprightly elf. But I, who liked it once myself, am now of quite another mind. Can't stand it. Reader, don't demur. Her older sister I prefer. Well, I guess I have a comment on that, but I enjoy this more right now. I'll give you more of my comments in a while, but here's how he continues the introduction stage. Tatiana was the sister's name, not hitherto in novels found. It's interesting. It's one of the most common names in modern Russia, but it was rather rare when Pushkin used it. It's sort of like Pamela. There are a lot of women named Pamela today, but in the 18th century, when Richardson published his novel Pamela, he got lots of letters saying, how do I pronounce that?
Interesting.
You just look at it, it might be Pamela. It wasn't a common name at all, a name of some rarity. Tatiana was the sister's name, not hitherto in novels found, self-willed. Though we are not to blame, we think our odd selection sound. Why not? Mellifluent to say, although I know that in a way it might recall archaic days or memories to common raise. In names too little taste we show. Of poetry I'm steering wide. Enlightenment won't quite abide with us. It had no chance to grow as yet. A strained affectedness. That's all we've gained, or even less. Well, let's pass to a beautiful extended portrait of Tatiana, okay?
Let's do that. Fascinated by her.
Thank you. This is when she's, for some reason, she doesn't herself understand it, but she's really falling for Eugene. He's a mysterious guy. He keeps to himself because of that Napoleon complex I mentioned, and also because I think of a certain kind of distrust or unease. A non-sympathetic person might just call it self-centered, narcissism and such. Anyway, he's a mystery, but she can't stop thinking about him. Can't fall asleep. Too stifling here. The window. Air. Come sit with me. Why, Tanya, what's the matter, dear? Tell Nanny how things used to be. I'm bored. What might you have in mind? When I was younger, I could find in memory old tales, for sure, of evil spirit, maiden pure. Today, mere dark. The things I knew, so many, but they've flown away. It's come indeed, the evil day, all shattered. Nanny, tell me true. I'll be more clear. I'll try again. Did you fall in love back then?
How does
enough?
How,
well, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, how does jealousy complicate the characters' lives? What role does that play as we see this evolving?
Oh, well, that's going to happen for a while. We'll turn back to Onegin and concentrate on that. But right now, let's go through this conversation because it's one of my favorite conversations in literature. This nanny has a lot to say. Enough, dear Tanya. Love's a word we'd never hear in times gone by. My husband's mother, had she heard of that, oh, I'd be like to die. You never spoke of love for men. But how did you get married then? I was 13. 'Twas heaven's will. My Vanya is short for Ivan, that is to say Johnny, My Vanya, he was younger still, 12, maybe 11. 2 weeks the marriage broker kept conferring with each relative, till father would permission give. He blessed me. Frightened how I wept, my braids undone as fitting they, with singing churchward led the way. I love replying to that one. In Shakespeare's play of Juliet, we learn, and this is a quote, she hath not seen the change of 14 summers. Interesting, huh? We're building on a tradition. We're talking about young women in love at age 13. Thus we get a sense, though one may find it strange, of early preparation for a maiden's love or marriage. War that supervened, as well we know, meant Juliet and Romeo would not be wed. Yet if they had their wish, another winsome bride of 13 years of age would bide in memory. For good or bad, when lives are brief and time is dear, adulthood might too soon appear. Then to another household they, but are you listening to me?
I am.
Oh, Nanny, what a great dismay. I'm depressed. Oh, wretchedly. I might start crying, I'm that sad. Oh, dear, my child, your health is bad. The Lord send mercy, grace, and aid. What are you wanting? If I made... Wait! Holy water drops you need. You're burning up. It's nothing of the sort that... Nanny, I'm in love. Dear child, be blessed. May heaven heed. She offered words of mercy, and she made a cross with fragile hand. The nanny, beldame, comes to mind, this is me speaking, from Romeo and Juliet in Keats' St. Agnes Eve. Keats retold the story of Shakespeare, of Romeo and Juliet, in his poem, St. Agnes Eve. A kind and frightened elder helpers met again. The women three combine, a child to bless with heaven's sign. When I the moving lines peruse, deep love may frighten, for we lose the power of stability, may readily be wounded by the one whose image in our eye depends on mental prophecy. In love we stumble when the soul cannot yet trust the other's role. I am in love. You can tell, I think, that I'm sort of in love with this whole scene.
Yes.
I am in love. I am in love, she whispered to her nanny. That I'm telling of. My darling heart, you're ill. And you, please leave me, nanny. I'm in love. And all the while the moon on high, a languid, weary light let lie on Tanya's pallid cheeks and fair, her disarranged, disheveled hair, her teardrops on the bench before our heroine in her dismay, the kerchiefed nanny, tresses gray, the padded jacket that she wore, a dreamlike atmosphere made still by captivating lunar will. I have a comment on that in terms of cultural history of 19th century depiction of women in both literature and painting. Rossetti, Hunt, Burne, Jones, Millay, for the four maybe greatest British artists and portrait painters of the 19th century, would readily have painted this. Details precise and heightened play a heartfelt part in lyric bliss with brooding and oniric, that means dreamlike, light, with that by their literary sight they bring to make divine the form of reverie that's legend warm. Pre-Raphaelite, the Lady of Shalott, in moated grange the one who'll weave more dream till autumn's done, to these envisioners of love, contemplative in wizardry, Tatiana seems akin to me. Her heart is carried far away to moonlight rays accustomed grown. She feels a thought has come to stay. Please go. I need to be alone. Please, paper, nanny, and a pen. That table. I'll lie down and then. Good night. She's ready to begin. All's quiet. Moonlight shining in. And head in hand, Tatiana writes. Eugene alone is on her mind, in style unpondered, unconfined, a maiden love breathes free, invites. The letter's done and folded soon, it's ready to be sent To whom? By the way, Pushkin writes the whole letter, and you can read it. It's one of the best. Also, there's so many best parts to this book, I can't begin to sample them all. If so confusingly from books her thought of love had all been gained, this candid modern woman looks like one who courage had attained for self-assertion in the cause of challenging the habit laws requiring that a maiden be withdrawn and waiting patiently. She'll suffer, as in love we do, but though she much may stand to lose, why opportunity refuse with blinded, narrow-minded view? She's very like Jane Eyre, I'd say, a mentor for the present day. I think that's it on that particular proverb. And now, what should we do? Oh, yes, you asked me.
Yeah, the jealousy. Jealousy, how that played into it. How did that complicate the lives of the characters?
Yes, yes. Well, we haven't said much about Lenski, Onegin's friend. What he did is he has fallen in love with Olga, the younger sister, whom the kind of woman that the author or the narrator used to like, but can't stand anymore. Well, here's a little love scene between Olga and Vladimir, who is going to become Onegin's frenemy, huh? Friend and rival.
Yes.
From hour to hour more captivated by Olga's beauty set astir, Vladimir, by the sweet unsated, surrendered all his soul to her. He's with her always. In her room they sit while stars the dusk illume. They're in the park while hand in hand they stroll on morning lighted land. And then, by love inebriated, enlivened shyly, tenderly, yet hesitating, sometimes he, by soon approving smile elated, will play with soft and curling tresses, or kiss the edges of her dress. All right, there's a bit of a picture.
Yes, it is. And if you're just joining us, our guest is Martin Bidney. That's B-I-D-N-E-Y. His website is martinbidney.org. This book we're talking about today is Alexander Pushkin's first novel, Eugene Onegin, a form-true dialogic verse translation with lyrical replies and supplements. Book available wherever books are sold, as are all of Martin's books. And we'll have all of this on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. How does the emotional crisis in Onegin relate to the life and the lyrical work of the narrator, Pushkin?
Well, I'll show you that in a moment. We have to review a bit, just for context, how the developing rivalry. It happens that they go to a ball, and Onegin makes a big show of dancing all he possibly can, just about all night, with Olga. And not paying any attention to the fact that, so to speak, she's already taken or spoken for,
yes,
or given her and surrendered herself to another person entirely. Well, the bitterness intensifies. I wish I could give you some of this buildup, and because it's suspenseful and very well portrayed psychologically. But what happens is, I'll give you a glimpse of the outcome. All right.
Okay.
All right, it's time. Cold-bloodedly, not aiming yet, the pair of foes, their gait, though quiet, strong must be, four paces measured out. You can guess, can you not, they're fighting a duo.
Yes.
Ah, those four fatal paces clearly seen. Advancing farther on, Eugene will be the first a hand to raise. To aim the pistol he essays, that is, attempts. Five more short steps, all measured well, and Lenski, narrowing one eye, to take his aim, would also try. But then Onegin shot. The bell of doom had tolled. The wounded bard let fall the pistol. Fate ill-starred. The author little gave away. Eugene remains a mystery. Cold hollowness, we know, would play a role in causing jealousy. Yet passionate, a magnetism led victims to a dread abysm. Friend Pushkin, by the way, died in a duel over a woman at age 38. Bred abysm, friend Pushkin, Tanya, Lyansky, all tempted, hypnotized to fall. The coldness of Apollo, I, to slyness Dionysal find, united in a double bind that drugs the blind, they know not why. We might an allegory key in this, a childhood story, see. Well, now I'm going to read a poem. Remember, I have really three big things to discuss. Onegin, Tatiana, and Pushkin, the poet, the lyric poet. I'll tell you a little anecdote. When I was working for my master's in Russian at Harvard, Professor Taranovsky, who taught a course in history of the Russian lyric, at the very first day of class, distributed this poem that I'm going to read to you in the Russian version, and said that today we're going to talk about this. And we talked about it. And the reason he liked it so much and thought that it ought to introduce the whole course is that he thought in these two pages, Onegin made, or rather, Pushkin made his Onegin poem clear, and everything about his personality, except it's like the oracle, you know, it's filled with meaning, but there's something quasi-holy about it.
Yes.
And something mysterious and what will always be what will resist analysis. Anyway, this is the poem. I can never forget that class. We were all worried about this poem, not worried, but struggling and fascinated by it, because it does not yield its meaning easily. But here we are. Pushkin's poem, Earliest Memories. Earliest memories return to me. So many carefree children in the school. We were a rough, unruly family. One teacher using mildness for a tool, though looking humble in a homely dress, now homely means ugly actually, majestically would affirm her rule. Surrounded by a crowd of us, no less would she continue speaking calmly, sweetly, serenely chatting. Bland impassiveness, that means indifference. I yet can see her head shawl knotted neatly, her clear and pure blue eyes, more bright than sky. But from her talk, I'd turn away discreetly. I found that I was irritated by the brow austere, the tranquil lips and glance, and most of all, the holy talk so high. To wish away the calm of countenance, I'd stubbornly distort her every saying, evading all the plain significance, and often stealthily attempted straying within the nearby garden's glory gloom, beneath its arch of porphyry delaying. The coolness of the shadows gave me room to roam within my dream, so comforting, so deep the pleasure, thoughts began to bloom. I liked still waters, leafy whispering, the pallid idols in the greening shade, immobile thought, each face emboldening. All that the sculptor had in marble made, lyre, sword, scroll, compass, held in hands of white, the head enwreathed, on shoulder, mantle laid, details that made a sweet, uncertain fright invade my heart. The wet of inspiration would fill the eye, so moving was their might. Two statues of miraculous formation, of magic beauty, over me would tower. Two demons glancing down from lofty station. The first, the Delphic idol, full in flower of youth, replete in wrath and awful pride, he seethed with alien, otherworldly power. The other was a female deified, sense-driven, doubtful, and duplicitous, enchantress demon, not to be denied. Before them I would stand oblivious, while, young, my heart kept pounding, and a chill passed over me. My hair stood up. I was by hunger dark tormented for the thrill of unknown bliss, lost hope and apathy enchained me, useless in my youth, until I took to living lonely, silently, in bitter brooding, for the garden idols had cast their spirit shadows over me.
So well done.
I'm glad you like that.
I feel like I'm there.
It's an amazing poem, really. It just stands by itself, and it doesn't even have a title. He didn't call it Earliest Memories. I had to call it. I thought I should call it something. But it comes to him. And the fascinating thing about poetry is it's impossible to say whether it ever even happened. But I have the feeling something like it must have happened. It had raised such a lasting effect. And, you know, it helps explain something about the power of this novel as a whole in general, because there's a lot of happiness in the novel, but there's also a lot of bitterness. I remember the Russian lines, "Как грустно мне твое явление, весна, весна, пора любви. How sad to me your dire appearance. Oh, springtime, spring, the time of love." So you see, he loves the spring and love, but there's a shadow over things. The spirits have cast their shadow, and they seem to be. It seems to be a conspiracy, because the man, the male and the female statues are equally portentous, are they not? I mean, they make you cry and shiver. It's almost like a way of seeing God, if you want. I think I won't comment on that. Maybe I'll just turn to what happens. What happens is, eventually, we're after the duel now. Would you like a little hint of what'll happen after?
Yes, please.
Her family figure, it's enough of lonely moping. She'll go to Moscow. And there she'll find who's available. We'll see who's available, and we'll look around, and all the relatives will help. This is already in chapter 7 out of 8, and it's verse 54. Her roaming thought must wander on, forgetting world and ball and stir. One gazer, though, will not be gone. Stout general, he stares at her. The aunties both begin to wink. Their elbow shove makes Tanya think. They only whisper, don't quite shout it. Look to the left, be quick about it. The left, but yes, but where? What's this? Quit asking things, look carefully. There, in that little group, you see, in uniform, two men, can't miss. He's moved aside, in profile, he... Stout general? You're kidding me. When Peter, here's my comment, when Peter, yes, the great Peter the Great, had made a double list of 14 ranks for war and peace, a cavalcade of generals he granted thanks for civil service, or a fight solidifying royal right. A heavy general must be a grand substantial guarantee of manor, land, and high estate, ensuring the transmission of whatever wealthy gentry love, who for a proper match await the stout of heart, or failing that, the heavy set. Don't name it fat. Not a whole lot more do we ever learn about this man. But I thought I'd give you a glimpse of him. He represents something like what some people are looking for on Tanya's behalf.
Yes.
Yes. Well, now I'd like to turn for maybe to end up with something that may combine the thematics of the Onegin novel with the poem that I read for you.
Please do.
Here's something. Actually, it's a rejected sonnet. He was going to use this to open chapter 8, and then he wrote something milder and, in my view, not quite so revealing for stanza 1. And it's lovely to read a scholarly edition. When I went to Russia in 1962 as part of a group course in learning how to speak Russian by going to Russia and speaking for 5 weeks with people in various cities, that's an unforgettable experience. At that time, I bought an edition of Pushkin, complete in 10 volumes, which I mailed home, and I used it when I was writing this book, my translation and dialogues. Anyway, here's Pushkin's rejected opening sonnet, and I hope it introduces, or rather culminates or looks back upon a mixture of moods, which I think may characterize Pushkin as much as the man he often tried to emulate, because he was also a playwright, Pushkin was. Let me just throw in another note here. Pushkin wrote a play called Mozart and Salieri, and the modern version of that is Schaffer's play and movie Amadeus. It owes tremendous amounts to Pushkin, unacknowledged by Schaffer, but we don't have to go into that.
Interesting.
Let's instead move ahead with that Pushkin opening sonnet that he rejected. I love it as a self-portrait of him. While flourishing compliantly within Lyceum gardens, I'd find Apuleius kind to me, but Cicero I'd put aside. He described him. Onegin like that. Apuleius tells bawdy stories, and Cicero writes noble speeches. The first Onegin and Pushkin favor, and the second they try to stay away from. When rarely to a poet famed, I'd not prefer a ball well aimed. Oh, gosh. Would at scholasticism balk and leapt the fence to garden walk, when I'd at times be diligent, at times self-willed, then lazy lie. At times straightforward, then be sly. Be mild, and then on mischief bent. At times I'd sad and quiet be. Then talkative, excitedly.
This has been so interesting, and the time has gone by once again way too quickly. Martin, I thank you so much for being here and talking and doing the recitation, and it is such a privilege to have you with us. The book that we talked about today, and there are many, I think over 60 at this point, written by Martin, and you'll find all those on his website, martinbidney.org, and you can link on by going to our website. This book, Alexander Pushkin's first novel, Eugene Onegin, A Form True Dialogical Verse Translation with Lyrical Replies and Supplements by our guest, Martin Bidney. The book available, of course, wherever books are sold. Information on his website. Martin, it is always a pleasure. We are just beginning to touch the surface of what all that you've done. And it's just such a pleasure to have you with us on the program. Thank you once again for being here and all of the emotion and passion you bring as a guest. A pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so very, very much.
It is once again our pleasure to have Martin Bidney on the program. MartinBidney.org is the website. All the information, of course, on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. We are back on today's program right after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.